Bright colours is what they likes, and jewelly, glittery things. It is no use in the world to explain or describe anything to them. They have no patience to listen. They cannot hold it in their minds.
Perhaps it is that they don't believe us,
Paris said, and was surprised to see a sudden gleam of humour come to the mate's face.
Not believe us,
Thurzo said. The idea seemed completely new to him.
I am known on that coast, he added after a moment.
Pick up, sir, I believe you are,
Barton said. So, the captain thought, he added, turning to Paris, since this is our last occasion here for a good bit, we had better have one at a fowl, and a very good thought, say I.
Thurzo turned his head slowly. My thoughts are not in your province, Mr. Barton. Good or bad, they're beyond your ken.
Aye, aye, sir.
The mate looked aside with his accustomed expression of wariness. He did not, however, seem particularly chastened by the rebuke, though he had fallen silent.
So they come out to the ship, then? Paris asked. Those selling slaves, I mean. We do not go into harbour.
But he saw instantly that he had once again given occasion for the conspiracy of contempt Thurzo had such relish for, saw it in the way the captain leaned stiffly forward in his chair and glanced to include the mate.
Harbour, Thurzo said. Off that coast. Where is your geography?
Oh, that's a good un,
Barton said, permitting himself a subservient echo.
Show me a blessed harbour there. I would like to see one.
We may get through the surf with a longboat to trade down river, Thurzo said, but we cannot stand in shore, not in those seas, Mr. Paris. You are talking about the windward coast of Africa.
I see, yes, Paris said.
My ideas of the coast are vague, I will admit.
He looked from the one to the other. They were united now in knowledge, but he sensed an understanding between them, much older. They had known each other before this voyage. His uncle had said so. Thurzo had asked for Barton as his mate. Something there was between them, though friendship it could hardly be called. It seemed more in the nature of a shared secret.
You and Mr. Barton have sailed together before, I believe, sir, he said.
He saw the look of satisfaction disappear from the captain's face, and his brows draw together suddenly.
Sail together.
Thurzo looked at the man before him, noting again the big, slightly awkward frame, the deeply marked face, touched by the sun now, showing the paleness of the eyes by contrast. These eyes were regarding him steadily, and they did not turn away from his frown. He was being stared at, aboard his own ship, and with eyes that contained some impertinent, some hateful quality of perception, of understanding. He caught sight of Barton nodding and turned his rage that way.
Damn you, do you sit there agreeing against me? I sail together with nobody.
He turned his eyes back to Paris and said less violently, The captain sails together with nobody. Mr. Barton has been my first officer on a previous voyage. So much is true. You have a lot to learn, Mr. Paris.
I know it, sir, and I'm doing my best, Paris said. I fancy you will understand things a deal better when we have slaves aboard. At present you think yourself superior to the business, I can tell. You are one of those who despise the money that is made from it. But mark my words, sir, you will go with a whip in your hand and a pistol in your belt like every other man aboard. Depend upon it, the keeper will very quickly decide which side of the cage he is on.
Will he so?
Paris spoke without pause for reflection, impelled by pride and a passionate sense of opposition.
You are admirably clear in your mind, if I may say so, as to who is caged and who is free. I know something of the matter, having seen both sides, but still cannot always see the difference.
Both sides?
Thurza's voice had no register for feeling. It came as hoarse and uninflected as ever, but his eyes were fastened on the surgeon's face.
How do you intend that remark?
Not caution, but enmity, restrained Paris now. He was silent for some moments, then said more calmly,
There are many would think the keeper is behind bars too, sir, for all his pistol and his whip.
Thurzo compressed his lips and looked aside. It was clear that he regarded this as not worth answering. Delivered now from the rage that had possessed him, he maintained an unbroken silence for the rest of the meal, and Barton, out of prudence or inclination, followed suit, though Paris felt the mate's eyes on him from time to time. He was relieved when he was able to get to his feet and bid the others good night. Somewhat to his surprise, Barton rose with him, and the two men left together. Up on deck they stood for a while at the stern. The moon had risen and stood clear of the sea to eastward, in faint wreaths of cloud. Barton seemed disposed to linger. He took a short-stemmed clay pipe from his pocket.
"Fair weather,"
he said, nodding towards the faint track of moonlight on the dark sea.
"When the clouds look singed-like round a low moon, I always find it follows with good weather. I don't know why it is, but I have always found it so."
"Well, I hope it proves so this time," Paris said.
There was silence between them for some moments. Then Barton said, in accents of sympathy,
"By God, he is a Tartar, though, our captain. The way he shot up at you tonight, and you give him no cause. He has done the same with me, many's the time. But you're a man of learning and scholarship, so you are bound to feel it more."
"I did not mind so very much."
Paris spoke coolly, warned by Barton's flattering tone. He knew the mate for a cunning fellow, and, in a way, dispassionate, a dangerous combination. He said,
"He seemed in good enough spirits to begin with. Something in my question annoyed him."
Barton puffed at his pipe in silence for some moments, looking down at the track of the moon, which was broader and brighter now.
"It was not in the question," he said. "It was in the way you looked at him. Captain Thurzo does not like to be looked at. He sets himself above it, if you get my meaning. But 'tis all bound up with the ship. He was put out of temper by our being so far eastward of the reckoning, which, as we have had fair winds and weather, must be owing to a demon of a current setting to eastward, and out of all nature strong, sir, it cannot be supposed less than 20 mile per diem from the time we passed the parallel of Cape St. Vincent. That is what put him out, Mr. Paris. Men like you and me, we take a broad view. Rain or shine, what's the difference?"
Barton paused, raising his face and smiling. The moon was clear of the cloud now, less blanched, more radiant. Light from it fell on the mate's face.
"What is a current?" he said. "It is just a setting of the water. It is like anything else in the world. Temporary. Everything is temporary in this world, whether it is the toothache or the love of women. But he takes it all personal. Now we have had a sighting of Tenerife to the west of us, so he knows where we are again."
"Well, it is strange," Paris said. "We can observe the movements of the heavenly bodies, we can chart the course of the planets, but not that of our own ship in a little stretch of water."
"By God, that is true."
Barton spat over the rail and laughed with apparent delight.
"It never come to me quite that way before," he exclaimed. "That is wit. That is what it means to be a man of education. But you have been in the school of life too, haven't you, Mr. Paris? You have seen both sides of the cage."
Paris remained silent for a short while, looking out to sea. The African coast lay somewhere to the east of them, in the direction of the moon. It seemed to him now that the ship was keeping to the broad track of moonlight. The sails were blanched. He made out a dark figure sitting alone in the cross timbers of the mainmast, and wondered if it were Hughes, who often sat there at night. He sensed the attentiveness of the man waiting beside him. The mate's question had come concealed in praise. Barton had a nose for weakness, for the festerings of spirit, and he was subtle enough to know that dislike is no impediment to confidences, that men of a certain cast of mind will confide even where they distrust, because not to do so shows fear or shame.
"Them was your words, I think,"
the mate said softly.
"Yes," Paris said. "A physician sees a good deal of life, you know."
He saw Barton relax his shoulders, as if in some release of tension. The mate paused a moment, then said in a different tone,
"All the same, he was right. The captain was right."
"In what way?"
"There is nothing like fear for keeping men together. Nothing else will do it, not in a slave ship. It is one of the chief snags of the trade that the merchandise has a tendency to rise on you. You wait till we have got upwards of 200 negroes chained between decks, all of them ready to dash your brains out if they gets a chance, and 20 men to guard him, feed him, wash him down, exercise him up and deck. By God, Mr. Paris, then you will see what fear can do to a man of learning and scholarship. It will bring him down to the level of the lowest scum aboard, what can't write his own name."
Barton's pipe was finished. With a gesture curiously dandified, he took a silver thimble from his waistcoat pocket, fitted it on his little finger, and pressed out the last spark in the bowl. The tone of these last words had been hostile, perhaps through disappointment at his failure to draw Paris out, but he now raised his face again, in the peering way characteristic of him, almost benevolent-seeming. Moonlight caught the thimble in a running gleam as he returned it to his pocket.
"Yes," he said. "You will know which side you are on, whatever you meant in there.
You will live in fear, like the rest." He nodded, still smiling, and turned to go below.
"It smells of excrement," he said. "You will get to know the smell, because them 200 or so blacks will be shitting in fear too."
Paris stayed alone on deck some minutes longer, then returned to his cabin. He was too disturbed in mind to think immediately of sleeping. It seemed to him that he had grown more impressionable in these last weeks, more easily affected by what he felt emanating from others. He looked more closely and saw more, not by conscious intention, but somehow helplessly. Increasingly of late, he had felt drawn into conflict with Thurso, a struggle too mortal for their short acquaintance. It was as if they had recognized each other as heirs to some ancient feud. Just now, on deck, Barton's rhetoric had oppressed him, and the moral vacancy he felt behind it. The mate had a sort of degraded subtlety about him, a scavenger's instinct for sense of weakness, and Paris felt himself that it was a weakness, this vulnerability to impression, this too strong sense of other human beings, almost like a failure of manhood. He blamed it on his isolation. In the removal of all that was customary in his life, some customary skin of protection also had gone, it seemed. He found solace for the spirit now in De Motu Cordis. The Latin text acted on him these days with the power of incantation. He had earlier been labouring to do justice to Harvey's paean to the heart's preeminence towards the end of chapter 8. Just as the sun deserves to be called the heart of the world, so is the heart the sun of the microcosm and the first principle of life, whose virtue quickens the blood and keeps it free from all taint of corruption. It was not, he reflected, that the analogy was original. The notion of the heart as the sun of man's being was an ancient one, deriving from Aristotle. But if you are about to demonstrate for the first time the difference between veins and arteries, and explain how the blood is transferred from the vena cava to all parts of the body, you may be allowed to borrow your comparisons at least. There were other great men, of course, who didn't. Paris thought, while preparing for bed, of Newton and that confession of ignorance in which he compares himself to a small boy playing with pebbles by the shore of a great unknown sea. This led him, by a leap he did not pause to examine, to thoughts of his cousin Erasmus and that lonely struggle of the 8-year-old boy to make the elements conform to his will. Memory of it came first in a wide perspective. The empty beach, the grey sea, the small, intent figure. Then, in one of those swooping approaches sometimes experienced in dreams, he drew near, saw the white face, the bloodied fingers. There was nothing in common here with Newton's image of human limitation. Erasmus had wanted to subdue the world. Paris recalled what Barton had said of Thurso a short while ago. He takes it all personal. But that staring child had no world to command. No ship, no community of men to wrench to the shape of his obsession. Perhaps because of his quickened thoughts, sleep did not come to him, despite the cradling motion of the vessel. He lay staring up through a darkness so profound that it cancelled all sense of confine. The deck above him was no nearer than the spaces of the sky beyond, and the planets in their obedient courses. Docile these too, he thought, as subject to laws, the motions of my heart, the flight and homing of the blood. Even in its rages, nature was always captive. Man, too, led in shackles from the womb. Death is a corruption which befalls by defect of heat, so Harvey defined it. Between the warm and the cold, the body flushes a certain number of times. Ruth's body, corrupted by defect of heat permanently. Again, he was harrowed by the thought that it was the unborn child that had nourished the mother. In prison, I was subject also to defect of heat, he thought, remembering the stone floor, the bare walls. At this interval of time, Norwich Jail had assumed the shape of a pit in his mind, with descending levels of damnation. At the lowest level were those who had no money at all and small means of obtaining any. He had been 1 week here, on the orders of the outraged cleric who owned the prison, as punishment for printing seditious views concerning God's creation. Here men and women fought with rats in damp cellars for scraps of food thrown down to them through a trapdoor, and huddled together for warmth upon heaps of filthy rags and bundles of rotten straw. Lunatics stumbled about here, women gave birth, people died of fever or starvation. These were people yielding no profit. Higher in the scale were those who could pay for food and a private room, and it was here that Paris, until redeemed by his uncle, had found lodging. 2 shillings a week had provided him also with writing materials, and given him access to the prisoner's common room, where there were newspapers and a fire in the coldest weather. But it had not been enough to free him from the stench of the place, nor the brutalities of some of his fellow inmates. Thieves and pimps mingled with debtors here. Higher yet, serenely above all this, and freed from unpleasant associations, were the rich prisoners, who lived as the bishop's guests, and entertained on a lavish scale. Norwich Jail had given Paris his notion of hell, and its workings afforded an example of docility to law, every bit as absolute as the motions of the blood postulated by Harvey. Money regulated every smallest detail of the place, from the paupers in the cellars to the profligate feasters above. All rents went to the bishop, who had spent £1,000 to acquire the prison, and was laudably set on making his investment as profitable as possible, this being a time when the individual pursuit of wealth was regarded as inherently virtuous, on the grounds that it increased the wealth and well-being of the community. Indeed, this process of enrichment was generally referred to as wealth creation by the theorists of the day. The spread of benefits was not apparent in the prison itself, owing to the special circumstances there, and particularly to the very high death rate. The keepers, at their lower level, sought to emulate the governor, pursuing wealth diligently through the sale of spirits, the purveying of harlots, and the extortionate charges to visitors. The visits had been an ordeal for Ruth, he remembered now. She was prone to nausea in the first period of the pregnancy, and the smell of the place had sickened her. She came with a handkerchief soaked in vinegar and held it from time to time to her nostrils. He remembered her face on the last of these visits, angry and distressed. She had been searched and subjected to indignities by the foul-mouthed viragos in the prison lodge, on the pretext she was a whore and robbed by them of a scarf. He had told her to keep up her courage, told her he would be free soon. Wide-eyed in the darkness, he saw, or feared to see, the distress on Ruth's face turn to reproach. He sought for a shield, and found one in the absurd and terrified appearance of a young debtor called Deaver, whose head had been thrust through the legs of a chair by his fellow inmates of the common room for his inability to pay chummage, the obligation to buy spirits for the company that was laid on all new arrivals. In this place of misery and shame, they aped the manners and adopted the ritual of those who had condemned them. Witnesses were sworn with due ceremony. Counsel made their pleas on one side and the other. A burly thief with a towel tied up in knots in imitation of the judge's wig solemnly pronounced the sentence. It was Deaver's face that Paris saw now as a refuge from Ruth's, ashamed and fearful, looking from his cage at the tormentors, who were his fellow prisoners too. So he lay sleepless, trying out versions of the past that might be tolerable to his imagination, while the deck above him lay awash with moonlight, and the ship made steady way, with all sails set, and a following sea. In this warmer weather, some of the crew found sleeping space on the deck. Callie, huddled in his blanket amidships, groaned in his sleep, beset by horrors. He started up at last, to stare affrighted across the moonlit deck, his face dewed with sweat. He had woken Deacon, who hissed at him, but Callie was still in the toils of nightmare and could not properly hear.
"What is wrong with you?" Deacon asked. "Why don't you sleep and give us some peace? There, get under your blanket."
"It came out my mouth,"
Callie said. He was shivering.
"Coming out and never stop."
"What are you talking about?
This white worm come out me mouth.
What worm?
Africa worm, long white un. You swallows it in the water. You can't see it when you drinks. It is too little. It gets bigger in your stomach, and it fills up with eggs, and it comes out to lay the eggs in the water. It can come out anywhere. It can come out your nose. It can come out your belly button.
Who told you that?
They told me.
Callie never mentioned names. His eyes started round the deck.
It knows when you go near the water,
he said with wonder. He was calmer now.
One come out his eye. That's why he got only one eye. It can come out your ear. It can...
Keep your voice down, Deacon said. You ought to have more sense, Dan'l. They were only trying to frighten you with them stories. You don't drink standing water anywhere in those parts where we're going. You stick by me. You won't get no worms.
He looked across the deck for some moments in silence. Then he said,
We will run, Dan'l. You and me, first chance we will get clear of this ship.
He had never included anyone else in his plans before. Since the day of his quarrel with Libby, he had known that he would have to run. No ship ever left harbour with a crew that could all be trusted. Haines or Libby or someone else would turn him in for the bounty as soon as they came up with a navy ship, or the captain would hand him over in the West Indies to save wages on the voyage home. Once they had unloaded the Negroes, there would be no need for so many men. There might be a naval frigate at anchor in Kingston Harbour. In any case, he could not wait to find out. For desertion, he could expect 200 lashes, and he did not believe he could survive so many. He would rather take his chance ashore.
When we get the chance, he said, when we get to Africa, you and me will run. But you must keep mum about it.
It can come out your arse,
Callie said. Fear had receded now, but he was unwilling to part with the horror of the worm altogether.
It can come out your nose,
he whispered, round-eyed in the moonlight.
Leave off that tack, will you? You and me will run. We will wait for our chance. Don't you talk about this to anybody.
Will we get some of them black cunnies?
You'll get nothing if you blab. You'll get a flogging.
Do you hear me, Dan'l?
As always, he saw himself breaking through, but this time not alone. There would be a place, dark among trees, where they could hide until all search was over. This would part like a screen, and they would pass into the open, into light.
I will look after you, he said, but you will get nothing if you blab. You will get a flogging.
I won't blab, Callie said.
He struggled for a moment with the idea of it.
What will we do there?
Do? We will go into trade. We will set up for ourselves.
He did not care, really. He was occupied only with thoughts of parting the screen, stepping through into the open, taking possession of the space. He spoke in whispers to the round-eyed Callie. There was a trade in ivory and camwood and gold dust. With money, they could take passage from Sierra Leone to Georgia or Carolina. His whispers went on, lulling Callie to sleep again, becoming briefly part of the life of the ship, the play of shadows over the decks, the slow creak of the boom, the faint language of the canvas and ropes. To these sounds, the captain, released for a while from his demon, slept in his cabin. Hughes, the climber, slept, wrapped in his blanket in the fore topmast staysail, and Thomas True in his hammock in the forecastle, lying face down to save his torn back. Sullivan dozed under the punt, and was discovered and kicked awake by the second mate, whose watch it was. Wilson, ordered forward on lookout, set his saturnine face to the glimmering horizon, and thought of ways of broaching the rum in the storeroom. In the darkness between decks, Evans and Johnson found each other. The moon rode clear in the sky now, and the ship's sails were the colour of bleached bone. Moonlight, falling through this high pyramid of sail, made of the deck another sea, with a trailing, glinting weed of ratline and shroud, and shoals of moonbeams flickering across her as the ship rose and fell. The real sea was unbroken, luminous to the horizon, with the utmost regularity, like a sleeper breathing in the deepest veil of sleep. The Liverpool merchant dipped into her moonlit reflection and rose, and dipped again, as if she could never have enough of her own image. The curving headrails, the full cheeks of the bows, the bosomy wraith of the Duchess of Devonshire, yearning up to meet her, and endlessly falling away. Part 4 Chapter 21 From where Erasmus was standing, he had a view across to the open farmland rising beyond Walpert's estate. The day was slightly fluffed with mist, and in this moister air colours were deepened. The distant cornfields, flat jade, the hedges of the beech walk from which the director would shortly emerge, soft emerald. Somewhere nearby a chaffinch was singing. Though waiting here in ambush, Erasmus felt a little drowsy. There are moments in anyone's life when some blend of circumstances, some consonance of surroundings and situation and character, show him in a light peculiarly characteristic, make him seem more intensely himself, to the observer, that is. The subject will not be aware of it. He seems to us, then, to be immobilized, taken out of time, or he steps, rather, into some much older story. So the blind mulatto, sitting among shadows, talking of paradise, so, to take an example among many, the first mate, Barton, extracting from a waistcoat pocket his dainty thimble, standing on the moonlit deck, explaining the nature of fear to Matthew Paris. So, Erasmus, waiting there, near the beginning of the alley that goes down between tall hedges of beech, waiting for the rival he has fashioned for himself to give grievance to his love. He is there imperishably, wild with his jealousy, vague with the peace of the day. He is always, always to be found there. He had watched Adams go up to the house for his snatch of repose, as the director was accustomed to term it. Madeira and biscuits were set out for him in a small room adjoining the library. He would return by the same path, ever more offensively free in his manners, or so Erasmus considered. He knew now that this confrontation was the only way. There had been no time for manoeuvring. He was convinced that Adams was plotting to expel him from the cast and bring in another Ferdinand to take his place and usurp his love. I'd rather force it to a fight, he thought. I would kill him, rather. With this, he came awake, experienced an increase of purpose, but the readiness to shed the director's blood was not new. It had been there already, implicit in his vow. He saw Adams, in his pale blue coat, descend the steps from the terrace, cross the short lawn below, and disappear between the hedgerows. He waited where he was for a minute or two longer, then took the few paces that brought him within the line of the alley. The other was approaching, the sunlight twinkling on his silver buttons. He was not more than 30 yards off. There was no way now that a meeting could be avoided, short of one of them turning abruptly about and retreating in the opposite direction. Adam's face showed small pleasure at the prospect of the encounter. On Erasmus, watching the director approach, waiting these final moments before speaking, the white gravel of the walk, the clipped green walls of the hedges, made an impression of neatness and order almost dizzying. "A word with you, sir, if you'll be so good." He encountered the insolently languishing dark eyes. This was perhaps the first time he had seen the director's face completely in repose, the first time, certainly, they had spoken together outside of the rehearsals. "Your servant, sir," the director said. "I am awaited, as you know." "It will not take long." He paused still, however, seeking to control his breathing. Adam's face, at close range, and in the intimacy of this narrow space, had brought back with a rush all his detestation, which for a while had been submerged in the business of contriving the encounter. This suddenly renewed sense of the other man's physical being, the eyes, the pimple converted into a beauty spot, the smell of attar of roses and ingested wine, confirmed touch by touch, lechery, treachery, all sins. "Well, what is it?" Adams was impatient. It was hot there in the enclosure of the hedges. "You might do better to be practising your lines. You have some way to go, sir, yet, before you can be deemed proficient in them."
"These lines I have rehearsed," Erasmus said, and even smiled a little. "I am perfect in them."
Adams failed altogether to catch the emphasis of these words, or hear the faint tremor of control underlying them. He was not a man who noticed others much, unless it was in the way of business. Moreover, he was at present rendered somewhat distrait with wine, as he might himself have put it. He had observed the unnatural straightness and stiffness of Erasmus's posture, and the fixity of his regard, but these he was familiar with already. They were characteristic of the young man in his role of Ferdinand, mere aspects to the director of Erasmus's general uncouthness and lack of talent as an actor.
"Well, I am glad of it," he said. "Is that what you waited here to tell me? But there is more to it than being able to recite your lines. There is a whole management of your movement on stage. There is the language of the body. This is between ourselves, my young sir, but I swear I never saw an actor so block-like in performance, so little in command of himself, and by God, I've seen some inept performers in my time. It is not a matter of the state you're in beforehand. There is Mr. Keith, presently at the Queen's Theatre. He was recently in a trifle of my own. You will not get him to go on at all without a pint of Burgundy inside him. But an immaculate performance, sir. Immaculate. Why, I remember Mrs. Bellamy. She would shake all over with nerves like a damn jelly, but cool as ice the moment she was on the boards. Dead now, alas, a great loss to the stage. But you, sir, if you will excuse me, you are a well-fashioned fella, and you have a good face, but you might as well be made of wood. You can't walk on with any grace. You don't know what to do with your hands. You don't know which way to look. Tell me, have you not thought of resigning from the play?"
"I may not know what to do with my hands as Ferdinand, but I shall know well enough what to do with them as Erasmus Kemp if you cannot learn to keep your own hands to yourself."
This, now that he had finally come out with it, he felt to be well-phrased, and the feeling did something to lessen his fury at the director's humiliating criticisms.
"I beg your pardon?"
For a moment or two Adams was slack-jawed with astonishment. Then he drew himself up.
"Here are rustic manners, indeed," he said. "We have awaked the boorish Daphnis, have we?"
"You will know what you have awaked, sir, if you persist in your insolent freedoms with these ladies."
Erasmus, who had not understood the reference to Daphnis, felt his rage begin to rise again.
"I will make you know it," he said.
For the first time, Adams looked directly into the younger man's face, something that disdain had hitherto prevented. His own face had whitened, but his voice was firm enough.
"It is not the ladies you are concerned for,"
he said after a moment.
"It is the pretty one, Woolpert's sister. Did she ask you to speak on her behalf?" "No, I thought not. Are you affianced?" "No, again. Well, sir, in that case, it is for the lady herself to make her wishes plain. She has not protested to me."
Adams made the mistake now of permitting himself a certain kind of smile.
"Quite the contrary,"
he said. Erasmus took a pace forward, and his hand went to the hilt of his sword.
"You beastly popinjay and sponger!" he said. "If you touch her again, I will kill you!"
His throat was dry, and his voice sounded remote and strange to him. Adams stepped hastily back, the rouge on his cheeks standing out in irregular patches against the pale skin.
"Do you offer to murder me?"
he said.
"For the sake of touches in a rehearsal, where such things mean nothing at all? Things I have hardly noticed and can scarcely remember, and she no doubt even less. You're mad! Stand away from me! I'm not wearing a sword!"
"You will have one in the house. I will wait for you here."
"Fight without witnesses and risk a capital charge? You're out of your senses! Stand out of my way! I wish to pass!"
"I will wait to hear from you,"
Erasmus said, and stood aside at last to let the other pass. He watched the thin-legged, agitated figure of the director recede, disappear, finally. The tumult of his heart quietened slowly, but this brought him no peace. Adams had not behaved as expected. It was not so much that he had shown no smallest trace of guilt or defensiveness. In such a reprobate, this was hardly surprising, but he had been taken aback. He had been astonished as well as indignant.
Of course, the fellow was an actor.
At the moment that the sun, was threatening a fellow being's life on grounds that, to anyone else, might have seemed flimsy, a report on the father's financial affairs, provided by the indefatigable Partridge, was being digested by old Walpert in his place of business on the waterfront.
"Time and money, sir," the scrawny, sharp-eyed lawyer had said, in the course of collecting the balance of his fee. "It generally comes down to that. The right relations between him is as important for the man of business as winds and tides for the mariner, and of the two it is the time that matters most. A man is rich so long as his creditors are patient."
It was surprising what Partridge, by means of innumerable small and grubby inquiries, had been able to find out. Much of it came as no surprise. Kemp, in company with others that Walpert knew of in the cotton trade, had suffered heavy losses in the disruption occasioned by the recent wars with France. On the ceasing of hostilities, he had, again, like others, imported quantities of raw cotton on credit, in anticipation of a boom in prices which had yet to materialise. Some of this he had sold at a loss to meet short-term bills. Much of it clotted his warehouses still. The Manchester dealers, with whom he had been accustomed to do a large part of his business, relied on resale to the manufacturers within a few days of purchase. Their profit margins were too low for them to buy at prices over the market. In this pass, Kemp had turned to printed cottons, entering into partnership with a textile firm of Barfield Brothers. For a while, according to Partridge's informants in Lancaster, they had done well, but printed cottons of Indian manufacture, transported in bulk in the huge East Indiaman, were daily increasing their share of the African and South American trade.
"Unfair foreign competition, sir, as any true patriot would agree," Partridge said. "These confounded Indian cottons are not only superior in the quality of their dyes, but they come cheaper on the market."
It seemed that Kemp had also laid out money to finance a dye works in Warrington in an attempt to find faster dyes. It was Partridge's general view, expressed in spidery writing and with all his customary discretion of phrase, that Kemp's resources were stretched, perhaps dangerously, but that he might have private means, outside the scope of the present inquiry, though open to investigation at a renewed fee if required, which might be enough to carry him through to the upturn in the cotton trade confidently expected on all sides. Walpert mused on this a while. He saw in it no great cause for alarm, certainly no grounds for suspicion. If Kemp could wait, he might do very well. Legislation was underway to impose tariffs on Indian cottons and protect the home industry. The bill might be delayed, there were powerful interests opposed to it, but it would go through. Newcastle was for it, and he would play the patriotic card in the House. With Indian competition choked off, there would be big profits for local dealers. Kemp might be short of ready money. He had built and outfitted the Liverpool Merchant on notes of hand at 18 months' date through merchant houses in Warrington and Preston, a total of some £12,000 by Partridge's computation. But this was common practice, especially in slaving enterprises. Even banks were ready to offer credit to slavers these days for the sake of the high interest. It was a kind of investment that made no appeal to the cautious Walpert. He sometimes made use of ships returning from the West Indies to carry his freight, but trading in slaves was too risky. Rewards were high, of course, on a prosperous voyage. Kemp stood to recover his 12,000 and make as much again in net profit, and that within the year. It came to him now that he knew very little about Kemp, though they had been acquainted for more than 20 years. A good man in company, fond of a glass, shrewd enough to all appearance, though too flamboyant and hasty for some, with those flushed good looks and that habit of eager gesture. Something extreme in him, a tendency to excess. In the son it was more pronounced, almost fanatical. The merchant still remembered the young man's statement of love and intention. He had thought it enough to make his wishes plain, and the blaze of his eyes on being rebuffed. Too much pride there, not enough sense of other people. But that would be supplied by commercial dealing, the best school there was for a study of human nature, so Walpert thought. Erasmus would not make such a bad son-in-law, if it came to it. He had energy and determination, more of both than his own son. Charles had a good manner and a proper sense of occasion, but he showed small aptitude for decision. He was obstinate, though, which was something different. Walpert sighed. The boy could not be budged on the matter of this actor fellow who was badgering the maids, drinking his way through the wine cellar and wearying his host each supper time with chatter about the theatre. It would give something to be rid of that fella, Walpert thought. He couldn't himself say much, because he had discovered that the whole thing was in honour of his 60th birthday, due the following month. Chapter 22. The Liverpool merchant had crossed the latitude of Capo Blanco and was making steady way southwestward toward the Cape Verde Islands. As the air grew more languid, preparations for accommodating the negroes grew the more brisk. Men were set to work splicing the hawsers for a long anchorage and serving the ropes of the longboat. The hold was rummaged to make space between decks. The open woodwork of cross-battens and ledges that formed the covers of the hatchways had to be raised so as to give more light and air to the lower decks. The carpenter's name was Barber, and he had picked out Blair and Sullivan to help him with the gratings. It was customary now to employ these two together.
"Well," Sullivan said, squatting to raise the framework on the starboard side, "a good deed lights a candle, as Miss Ainted Mother used to say, and God will spy it shinin'.
I thought you'd given God his last chance the day they pressed you on this here ship," Billy Blair said.
"Lift your bloody end a bit, will you? I never seen anyone like you for husbandin' his strength. What good deed are you talking about?"
"By raising up these hatches, we're delivering parcels of light and air to the heathen below, and sweetening their passage. Some of them fellas, a certain proportion of them black fellas, will live to cop the sugar because of what we're after doing now. Isn't that right, Mr. Barber?"
The carpenter, a morose, squat, long-armed man, said,
"If talking was rated high, you would be Admiral of the Fleet by this time, Sullivan, instead of an ordinary seaman. We'll have to take this right off altogether so I can put a trim on it."
"You're wrong anyway," Billy said. "As bloody usual, we are just doing what we was told to do. If they had set to lower the grating and leave the beggars in the dark, we would have done it just the same."
Sullivan glanced up at the bright sky as if for patience. His hair had grown again after that drastic cropping. It stood up from his head in a thick, black, softly bristling mat. His long-jawed face had darkened with the sun, making the eyes seem more bemused than ever, straying after some vision just lost.
"In that case," he said, "since it would be a wilful act and contrary to practice and with no grounds in reason or law, it would be a dastardly bad deed, and Old Nick would make a note of it."
At this flagrant illogicality, Billy felt the onset of a familiar baffled fury.
"I don't know how it is," he said,
doing his best to disguise this while at the same time holding up his end of the grating,
"but any attempt at conversing with you gets a man in a deadlock in no time."
"It is you, Billy," Sullivan said mildly. "I never arrive in deadlocks with nobody else."
"Listen to me, for Christ's sake."
Billy shifted on his haunches and spat over the rail.
"If it is a good deed to raise the gratings on these hatches," he began slowly and laboriously, "what are we doing putting the quashies down there in the first place? Them fellas gets light and air enough in the forests where they are."
"This is commerce we're talking of now," Sullivan said. "It comes under a different heading entirely."
Billy felt the heat rise in his head.
"Now, just a bloody minute."
"You're both of you ignorant beggars," the carpenter said. "You ain't been on a slaver before, have you?"
Sullivan assumed a smile of patent falseness.
"No, Mr. Barber, we have not," he said. "But we are dying to learn, ain't we, Billy? I was just saying the other day, I think it was to Dan'l Cally, who you see picking yarn down there this very minute. He might seem slow, Dan'l, but he has an inquiring mind, and he was asking me something to do with the trade, and I says to him, 'You better ask one of the officers. You better ask Jack Barber,' I says, 'someone who knows the slaving business inside and out.'"
The carpenter looked at him darkly for some moments, then he said,
"You are both talking as if it is the men that will lie below here. But this grating is the one over the women's room, not the men's. We always puts the men in the forrard room, the boys in the middle, and the women in the after part."
"Now, that is something we never had the slightest inkling of," Sullivan said.
Billy Blair sat back on his heels and pushed the red cotton kerchief up over his heated forehead. He looked towards the waist, where Callie and McGann were working together. Callie was sitting up against the gangway ladder, pulling out yarns, his big hands picking at the strands with surprising nimbleness, his blunt, seal-like head lowered in absolute concentration. He was naked to the waist, his powerful torso a smooth red-brown. The skinny McGann was working the hand winch to twist the yarns into rope. The doctor was beyond him, taking his walk on the weather side of the deck. Thurso and Barton stood talking together on the quarter-deck. The dry rattle of McCann's spindle resounded through the ship, all the sound there was. Billy thought of the women and felt the rage of argument recede.
"It hadn't come into my mind they would be separated," he said.
"The women are below here, then."
"Aye, that's right. You can get up to 100 in there if you stow 'em spoon fashion, arse by tit."
"But gob, 100 black fannies," Billy said.
The weasel-faced Tapley, passing with a bucket of hot pitch, heard this and paused, grinning.
"He thinks he's going to creep down when no one is looking and shag himself silly," he said.
"You shag off yourself with that bucket," Barber said severely, jerking his thumb. He did not like anyone much, but Tapley less than most.
"No," he said to Billy, "you have to get them on their own if you want anything. On the deck, maybe, or get one down in the room while they're exercising up here. No good going below, except with a whip. They get into states. They get shrieking wild sometimes, especially when the weather is bad. They would have you down and chew your bollocks off."
"Persuasion is best in any case," Sullivan said. "I know women. They're sensitive. A little bit of kindness goes a long way with women."
Paris, turning at the end of his 20 paces, had observed Tapley's brief pause with the bucket and his unpleasing smile. A distasteful fellow, Tapley.
What was it? He seemed to have no nature of his own. In moral terms, a rudimentary worm indeed, eyeless in the dark.
Many of the men on board he had felt to be stricken in some way, made brutal or heedless by the circumstances of their lives. He had sensed some loss, something visited on them, feelings cauterized. But Tapley was without this emanation of a hurt or dispossessed creature. He writhed complete, his evils effortless. Or so, Paris thought, it seems to me.
And what, after all, gives me the right to judge? And if indeed I have the right, what persuades me I can see the truth of another human being, and one with whom I have exchanged almost no words? Nothing persuades me in reason, and yet I know.
Once again, he was swept, desolated almost, by the lonely certainty of his perceptions. He paused at the rail, looking eastward towards the invisible coast of Africa. Sight of land, when it came, would reduce them, set them once again on the margin of existence. Here, ringed round with the ocean horizons, one felt at the centre of the world. The land, so much longed for, signifying the end of exile, would make them mere loiterers again. It came to him now that this paradox lay at the heart of all desire, as true for himself, standing perplexed at the rail, as for every other man on board, whatever Africa represented to him. Not that all points of the horizon appeared equally far away, even to the casual and naked eye. He knew, he had seen in this succession of days, how there is always a point more distant in seeming than all others. Depending on the position of the sun and the distribution of light in the sky and the bulk and drift of cloud, one part of the rim will always be notched with remoteness. Is this a notion of infinity? Paris wondered rather wildly, glancing round for it now, holding to the rail, feeling his body move with the sway of the ship. Can such a notion derive from sense impression merely? So Locke would have it, with his denial of innate ideas, but the consolations of philosophy were limited, he found, aboard this ship. Locke defined pleasure as the reward of the just. What then should one call the emotion that lightened Libby's face or brought a glint to the eyes of Haynes, the boatswain? He could hear the rattle of the winch from amidships. A smell of hot pitch lay over the ship. Simmons was shouting orders for the fair-weather sails to be hoisted. Paris found his remoter point and fixed his eyes upon it. The sun, concealed in cloud and low in the sky, made shafts and corridors and vaults to give infinity a baroque ornamentation. But it was there, Random impurities swam in the depths and were dissolved. Next day, the slave rooms were marked off and work was begun on the forward bulkhead. The stateroom had already been stocked with an assortment of goods from the hold. Now a new main-to-gallant sail was bent and the old one primed, as soon as taken down, with resin and oil, so as to make an awning for the quarter-deck, where the shipboard dealing would be conducted. Johnson, the gunner, began making cartridges for the swivel guns. Two hogsheads of spirits were drawn off to sweeten the native dealers.
"Them fellers has got all her legs for the stuff,"
Barton said to Paris, with the peering relish characteristic of him.
"All the marrow has been liquefied out of their bones, I do believe, and there will be work to keep our lads off it once it has been broached. A flogging won't keep them off drink when the smell of it is about, any more than it will keep them off the women, Mr. Paris. That is only human nature."
And still Thurso did not know precisely where he was. He had seen no land since sighting the highlands of Tenerife. There was no means known to navigation in that summer of 1752 which could have helped him to determine his longitude. The water continued to deep sea colour, giving him hope he was not too much out in his reckoning. According to this, he should have been at least 50 leagues northwest of Cape St. Anne. All the same, he was anxious. The banks lying off the Cape were the dread of all Guinea traders. Thurso had encountered powerful indrafts there on previous voyages, and he knew cases of ships drawn into the shallows, sported with by fickle breezes for days or weeks, or grounded in the shoals. He took soundings in 30 fathoms, and the lead showed coarse red sand and fragments of shell, indicating they were further eastward than he had expected, nearer the coast. To make matters worse, the weather was thickening to the west. He gave immediate orders for the ship to be put about. Hughes, the climber, on lookout in the crow's nest, heard the shouted orders and felt the ship quiver through her length as she was brought closer to the wind. A mackerel sky was building to westward, with dark banks of storm breeders low on the horizon, but there was some sun still lying flat on the sea. He watched the gulls which earlier that day had found the ship. They were following on the starboard side, fewer now, but in good number still, which made him think they were in for no more than light squalls. He tried to count the birds, but lost himself in the rising, dipping dance of their flight, the constant changing of position among them, 30 at least, completely silent. Seabirds were mute at the approach of bad weather. He knew that about them, and much else besides, whatever could be understood from close watching. Animals and birds, any creatures other than human, he had always liked to watch. He noted again how the birds rode the wind, how the dying sun flashed on their breasts. Below them, the sea was riven with gashes, the wind was rising. He looked away from the birds at last to eastward. The horizon on that side was pale and clear still, and Hughes saw, faint and ragged but unmistakable, the shapes of land. He cupped hands to mouth and bawled the fact to the darkening sky. Thurso, standing forward of the helm, heard the cry from aloft and the boatswain's long-drawn lamentation of response. "Where away?" He did not wait for the lookout to answer, but at once raised his glass. When the answer came, with a rough bearing to larboard, Thurso had already found them, shifting, evanescent, but no shapes of clouds or sea, a line of deep, irregular serrations. A rippling swell swept the ship up and dropped her, and he lost his view. But he knew he had seen the mountains behind the Sherborough River, and in these moments of pause, in the cool breath before the onset of the squall, Thurso made proper acknowledgement to his counsellor for having brought them so far eastwards in deep water, beyond the sucking evil of the shoals. Chapter 23. Throughout the day the wind had been rising, smelling of rain on the way. It sent ruffles across the lake and swept up the spent May blossom into miniature storms. The cast of the Enchanted Island had assembled in the library, where a fire had been lit. "We are all here, I think," Charles Walpert said, his accustomed gravity of manner contending with a certain visible embarrassment. "Except for Parker, that is. He had duties in the parish. It seems the vicar has returned. And, of course, Mr. Adams. He paused on this to clear his throat before continuing. I don't want to beat about the bush. Mr. Adams is threatening to leave us. In fact, he talks of decamping on the spot. It appears that dissatisfaction has been expressed with his manner of directing the play. He doesn't go into details, but he names the person. I see no reason why we should not all know who it is. It is Erasmus Kemp. Several people glanced at Erasmus now. He looked straight before him. His face wore a slight frown, but he was otherwise impassive.
Good heavens!
Prospero had passed instantly to red-faced, swelling indignation.
That is a piece of barbarity, he said. What? Did he presume to speak for us all?
It seems that Mr. Adams was intercepted, Charles said. Is there anyone here you consulted beforehand, Kemp?
No,
Erasmus said after a moment. He had had to struggle with himself to answer at all in face of this public questioning.
It wasn't the business of anyone else. I didn't speak to Adams about his direction of the play. That is a lie. It was a personal matter. He had no business to complain to you.
No business to complain to me? Charles paused for a moment or two, as if at a loss. Then he said more loudly, He is a guest in my father's house, at my invitation. He has received discourteous treatment. Who else should he complain to? I must tell you, Kemp, I think you have behaved strangely, and you may make of that what you like. For the first time, Erasmus turned his head to look at his interlocutor. Resentment at this public rebuke showed in his suddenly heightened colour and fixity of gaze. This was her brother. A quarrel was out of the question. All the same, it came to him now that he had suffered discomfiture enough from the Walperts, father and son. When we are married, he thought, I will keep her from them. There was a keenness of pleasure in this thought, which he did not pause to examine. For a moment he allowed his gaze to fall on Sarah. She was standing in the recess of the window with her back to the light. She was looking at him steadily, but he could not detect any change in the normal composure of her expression.
I'm fair sick of the whole business, Charles said. I'm sorry now that we thought of it in the first place. Jonathan Rigby was well out of it when he broke his leg. I swear I'll never be in a play again.
Me neither, the young man who played Hippolyto said.
We have given up hours to it. To speak frankly, I don't care for Adams much. I don't think he is further the play, and he takes us for ninnies. I don't care if he goes.
Nor do I, Dorinda said suddenly and unexpectedly, tossing her head, perhaps remembering some slight or belittlement.
Well, Charles said unhappily, now we are coming to the point.
Adams has made it a choice. It is either Erasmus or him, he says. Either Erasmus withdraws from the play and ceases to attend rehearsals, or he takes post from Warrington tomorrow morning. There was a short silence. Then Erasmus said,
I won't be forced out by Adams. I will resign from the play if everyone has agreed they want me out of it.
It was the only card he had to play, but it was a strong one. He could not believe Sarah would vote against him, even to save the play, and there was a good chance that dislike for Adams would keep some of the others on his side, and that deliberations about expelling him would collapse in disorder, along with the play itself. He gave the company a short bow and left the room, passing through the house and out onto the terrace. As he descended the steps and walked towards the lake, he heard the wind in the high branches of the trees and saw the rapid scud of clouds in the sky. Once among the trees, he stood still and breathed deeply, as if he had been running. The humiliation of that public interrogation, the rein he had kept on himself, brought their sharp reaction now. For her sake, he had suffered it all. The words ran fiercely through his mind again. When we are married. Once more, he became aware of the wind and the trees above him. He raised his face and saw the branches swaying and rooks flung across the sky beyond. When the battle is equally poised, the outcome will often depend on chance. Victory, had Erasmus known it, was being achieved for him not very far away. The curate, Parker, seated in the vicarage drawing-room opposite the vicar himself, in a chair that was neither easy nor upright, but partook of the awkward qualities of both, saw through the casement window how the wind was agitating the yews in the garden, shaking them until they lost all resemblance to trees and became like dark, tossing plumage. With them, he seemed to see his role as Caliban in the Enchanted Isle, dislodged, shaken loose, blown away forever.
"We live in dangerous times, sir. Perilous,"
the Reverend Edward Mansell said,
"and crucial for the Church."
He was a robust man, well rounded out, with a full gaze and a high, pale forehead and abundant auburn hair, of which he was proud. His black broadcloth suit was of best quality, and his collar was of a snowy whiteness amazing to Parker. He said, "It behoves..."